About if you want, we can get started.
Okay. All right. Well, I decided to take this topic up because I read Ayn Rand's essay on the topic. She had an essay called An Untitled Essay, in which she sort of blasted meritocracy. And I thought it was one of the less formulated essays that Ayn Rand had done, where she sort of said it was an anti-concept and a contemptible package deal. And I think I had another understanding of meritocracy. The literature on it is gargantuan, and I wanted to sort of take up meritocracy in its rich, nuanced sense that I don't think Rand really dealt with quite properly. And since this is open objectivism, I am an objectivist, I'm an admirer of Ayn Rand, but I think that sort of constructive criticism of the way that she dealt with it is necessary. So I wanted to sort of rescue meritocracy from the way she sort of just dismissed it as this contemptible thing, and really give a proper definition of meritocracy and why I think, against the backdrop of certain social maladies, it is something that is quite restorative and quite proper and ethical. So when we think of meritocracy, I think it is, given the literature that I've read and the dictionary's definition and various dictionaries, it's basically a social system in which the success and status in life depend primarily on individual talents, abilities, and effort. It's a social system in which people advance on the basis of their merits. Okay? So when we think of a meritocratic society, we think of a meritocratic system. It contrasts with an aristocracy where people advance on the basis of this on status, titles of family, and other relations. So when we think of our good old United States of America, we properly think of it, we have thought of it as a sort of meritocratic society, right? Because we think of meritocracies, meaning societies that are built on the belief that if you work hard, if you have dedication, if you're resilient, if you pull yourself up by the bootstraps, then you can make it based on your merits and not on any kind of special pull or privileges. So it's written also against the backdrop that our culture is dominated and ruled by the principle of what Rand properly called metaphysical egalitarianism. And here I think Rand is absolutely right. That is, metaphysical egalitarianism is the belief in the equality of all men, where we're not talking about equality before the law. Equality is taken to be the equality of personal attributes and virtues, regardless of natural endowment or individual choice, performance, and character. So egalitarians are not talking about man-made institutions, but nature. That is, they want to defy what she calls the law of causality. They want a demand for equal results from unequal causes, or equal rewards for unequal performance. And what we see as a sort of consequence of that is a leveling down of mankind to the common denominator of its least competent members. So equal results from unequal causes and equal rewards for unequal performance is an abrogation of the law of causality, because you cannot redistribute values, and you cannot redistribute the various attributes that allow for unequal outcomes, like intelligence, like frugality, like athletic prowess, just the various attributes that we have that we do not have in common. You cannot redistribute. How do you redistribute those? So we see this tangibly in the assault on excellence in academia. We see it in the divestment, equity, and inclusion initiatives, where the criterion for employment rests not in merit, excellence, but diversity based on gender, race, or in this case now, trans identity. I also want to talk about it against the backdrop of academic or corporations that are suffused by a woke ethos. more importantly, we see this taking place in the idea that truth and logic are so criminalized today. They're seen as the constructs of racist white imperialists, and that they're not up to the task, or that they cannot adjudicate among truth claims, as there is no objective reality out there to adjudicate as an arbiter, and that there are no philosophical meaning tests to corroborate or validate these arguments. We also live in a culture where feelings are invoked as sources of authority, and feelings are presented as reasons why others should defer to the view of a speaker or discount someone else's. And let's say you take a feeling like rage, or you take a feeling like anger, and it's taken as a justification for truth. And so the dialogue itself is killed because it is putting the ground of judgment beyond the reach of other participants. We can't share. I don't have access to someone's feelings, right? Rather, I think the justification or the justificator methodology should be reason, which is an attribute we all share and which is open to all. So we see the assault on excellent and excellence. We also write against the backdrop of what's called de-leveling, which is taking place in a lot of K through 12 educational programs, where honors programs for academically superior students are dropped on the premise that it is discriminatory. And against whom? Against the slow learners, against the cognitively challenged. So again, if you think of the proper definition of meritocracy as a social system in which success and status in life depend primarily on individual talents and effort, a social system in which people advance on the basis of their merits, we can see how these programs are really bent on paralyzing those who have talent and who have merit. Jose, one of my favorite philosophers, who I know Ayn Rand liked in her early 30s, or she didn't. She through various sources, it's been known that she respected him tremendously. She didn't name him as one of her influences, but he's certainly one of my favorite philosophers, José Ortega Gasset. I just finished teaching him. In his Revolt of the Masses, he makes a number of very interesting claims, which he wrote this book before Ayn Rand wrote The Fountainhead. And you can see some of his influence, I think, on her thinking. And I just want to read a couple of quotes here. He says the mass man, or the average man, becomes a qualitative determinant. He's a social stray man. He is the measure in which he's undifferentiated from other men. Man repeating in himself, he's a generic type. And what is there in this conversion of quantity into quality? Simply this: by means of quality, we can understand the genesis of quantity. He says, we can tell a mass man when we see one. This person represents a mass phenomenon. The mass man is anyone who does not value himself for good or ill by any particular criterion, and who says instead that he's just like everybody else. The mass man is those who demand nothing of themselves in particular, for whom living is to be at all times what they already are, without any effort at perfection, boys floating on the waves. Another interesting quote from him, he says, the masses have become intractable. The mass man does not comply. He does not follow rationally. He does not respect natural minorities. He pushes them aside and supplants them. And another a very interesting quote, sounds mu very much like Rand, a very interesting quote. He says, history is not dependent on the decision of mediocrities, or to put it in the active voice, the mass man, hitherto directed from above, is now dominated or determined to govern the world. One more quote from José Ortega y Gasset, on page 14 of The Revolt, the brilliant book, The Revolt of the Masses. He says, well, I'll just stop there. Let me go on, because I want to get through what I have to say. So history, in some sense, is dependent on the decisions of mediocrities, or the sensibilities of the common mass person whose ethos and whose sensibilities supersede those who have more refined and honed and sustained standards. So the question really is, How do we get here? We can sort of try to understand the provenance of this new kind of sovereign mass as an intractable mass that constitutes a confederacy of nihilistic supplanters. And as how do we get here? We could go back to the importation of critical theory. We could go back to postmodern and deconstructionist thought, the Frankfurt School, all of which gave rise to the revolutionary victim studies programs of the 1960s, Black studies, women's studies, postcolonial studies, LGBT studies, all of which declared war on Western civilization and the Western canon. The use of reason and logic, again, as unassailable, incontrovertible tools to arbitrate among truth claims. And I think the epistemological calumny, in some sense, of their combined methodologies led to the elevation of ethical relativism as a national norm. And it has suffused discourse in one manner or another and led to the outright disbelief in the idea that there is an objective reality. So what is the ultimate bottom line, before I get to the sort of ethical upshot of meritocracy? Well, our universities certainly have become existential disruptors. They, I think, are terrorist cells, silos that have morphed into one kind of irreducible primary, the categorical destruction of the Republic of the United States of America. And the cultivation, where the cultivation of excellence and the high goal of preparing students to be sovereign and autonomous citizens have been superseded by overt political consciousness raising with the goal of assailing the First Amendment and to invoke systemic nihilism, strategic systemic nihilism, and the destruction of all values that undergird the Republic. So the question is, I often ask myself, how do we get here? And I think the answer is liberalism, and it's the beauty and the tragedy of liberalism is that it allows everyone into the historical process and ipso facto into the future. So heaps and heaps of people have been thrust upon history and at such an accelerated speed that it's impossible to sort of incorporate them into a rational demos in a secure and fastened manner because there's no vetting process really. So what we find under liberalism is that the democratization of any life sphere, whether it's education, entertainment, has a leveling effect where, again, we find the leveling down of humankind to the common denominator of its least competent members. And we have a new sovereign mass, a sort of intractable mass that constitutes a confederacy of nihilistic supplanters. So, I have about 5 more minutes, and I want to say that the person of excellence, the meritocratic individual, strives to seek a status over and beyond what he or she is. It's an aspirational identity that becomes a moral virtue in that it involves the shaping of the self into an embodiment of excellence through rational means, right? It's a life of effort, of volition, and values that shape a life that determines or deeply influences one's identity. And the volitional aspect underlying the system of meritocracy is where the system gains its moral upshot. So excellence, cultivated and honed ability, which translate into merit, is a trading currency, I think, which grants one's just deserts in life. And that's not inherited status, that's not privilege, which are the hallmarks of an aristocracy. So applied excellence, I think, is both a predicate and a concomitant of an act of volition, a will, a free will, in search of the highest, most exalted form of living, a life of sustained flourishing that is based on a set of what I would call pre-existing virtues that are the material means for achieving a meritorious status. Sustained rational thinking, resilience, in Rand's term, holding productive work as one's noblest activity, consciously at all times, and bearing in mind that falling below the excellence threshold commits one to a life of mediocrity, a life of compromised agency, which stymies and thwarts one's ability to live optimally. And one uses one's meritorious agency as both an inoculant and an antidote to social ballasts and to existential sinkholes who drag the aesthetic and cultural value and the quality of life for everybody by means of their ability to, in a totalizing manner, insert their non-values, I think, as normative prescriptives in the world. So I think meritocracy, read this way, codifies into a pyramid of ability those in a society who, simply put, are its best. Whether we're talking about janitors, doctors, carpenters, engineers, the bus driver that Ayn Rand starts out Atlas Shrugged with, hedge fund managers, it is the vetting agency against the ravages of hyper-democracy, which is a system that lets everyone into the domain of creative human social intercourse. And today, it remains agnostic on the creative hierarchy that judges those to be excellent, good, average, bad, and just worthless. Next week, I'll talk about how elitism, properly understood in the non-political sense, is a corollary of a proper system of meritocracy, a sort of aristocracy of refined and sustained and higher sensibilities and conceptions of a good life. And that'll be the topic for next week. So I did not want to go over 20 minutes, and I did not, because I wanted there to be room for questions. Yeah.
Yeah, let's mix it up. First of all, I just want to recognize a few people in the room. Jair, chairman of the board of the Atlas Society. Also my creative partner, Patrick Riesenover. It's great to see you here. We are going to start taking some questions. I want to also thank Scott, who's always a master of these rooms and a co-host here at the Atlas Society. We're going to take some questions, so just go ahead and raise your hand. I would love to ask you all a favor, if you would please tap that little share button down below, and please share it on Clubhouse, share it if you're on Twitter or Facebook. I'd love to get some other people, ping some other people into the room. It would be really wonderful. So I'm actually going to, as I usually do, if we have a either another scholar or, of course, a trustee of the Atlas Society, I'm going to go to Jay LaPere first. Jay?
That's great. Jason, this is a terrific topic and really appreciate you taking it on the way you do. Can you comment on the relationship between, and I don't want to take you afield from where you are, but determinism and how that is used to undermine meritocracy and attack, and then also the role of luck, which is a fact, but it's the primarily, the results are primarily influenced by the agency and virtues of the actors. Can you hear me?
Yeah, Jason,
I have to unmute myself. Yeah, there I go. I think determinism, the determinists try to, are the original metaphysical egalitarians in the sense that they somehow state that either one's genes or one's genetic component or one's inheritance of one's character. Or one's disposition is determined by some sort of causal phenomenon outside of one's capabilities or outside of one's volition. And therefore, you know, the liberal state has an obligation to sort of, Rand wrote about this, has an obligation to undo what has been endowed by nature or what the individual, him or herself, can't alter, which is an ineradicable component of one's DNA or one's makeup in some way. And so I think egalitarianism or egalitarians sort of try to win that argument by showing that every component of or every attribute that could influence one's destiny or have a share on the course of one's life, let's say in terms of one's upward mobility, is certainly outside of one's capabilities because one is already predetermined by attributes over which one has no control, like intelligence, which we know is just not true. We know that there are things that one can do to improve one's mind. So that's briefly, that's the first way that I would answer that question. And what was the second part of the question, Jay?
How luck is claimed as the dominant factor.
Right. Well, I mean, this is sort of like this is another way that the metaphysical egalitarians try to win or coerce a liberal state to sort of impose on the rest of society a set of laws or mandates, in the sense that I think they really overstate luck. No one can deny the role that some role that luck plays in a person's life, right timing, right place at the moment. But you look at successful people and you realize that no successful person who has sustained success over a long period of time could have had that much luck occurring every single day, every single month, every single year of one's life. So I think the best rejoinder to the luck argument would be to say nobody could be that consistently lucky every day, every year, every month of their life to sustain a successful way of life. That is, a person might have been lucky at one point, and there's nothing that one can do. One can't punish a person for being lucky. But more importantly, even if one is the lucky recipient of luck, it's what one does with that luck. And luck alone might be necessary, but it's certainly not a sufficient condition for sustained and protracted success in one's life. One has to sort of capitalize on that luck and use one's mind and one's ability to do with what that luck avails itself, or how that luck avails itself to a person. So the luck argument I'm never won over by, because to live a life, an optimal life, a sustained life over a protracted period of time, one is never, one luck doesn't deal itself out in such generous doses to one person so significantly over a protracted period of time.
Yes, thank you.
And there's also my favorite quote by Branch Rickey, that luck is the residue of design. And there's, of course, the luck of your birth or misfortune of your birth, depending on how you came into the world. But so much of what is seen as luck is often just the result of many, many years of making the right moves, the right choices, and setting yourself up to have more luck in life. So, all right, John Lang, also a long timer with the Atlas Society. Love the profile pic, John.
Thank you. Jason, I just want to congratulate you. Your opening statement was marvelous. So many original ideas, and if not completely original, then new and interesting formulations and constructions and little set pieces of rhetoric that capture critical, important ideas going to your overall theme. And I also, something everybody knows, we live in a zeitgeist or a paradigm of egalitarianism, which has gone to toxic extremes. And you're onto something here. Thank you. And I'm sorry, it doesn't contribute much, but thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, John. That means a lot to me. Thank you.
Thank you, John. All right, Thales.
Hey, thank you, Jennifer, and thank you, Jason, for doing the room. Jason, I've interacted with you quite a bit in some of the rooms that Greg Greg has hosted with you in the past. In any case, I wanted to ask you a couple things. One of the very interesting things that I find is, there's the concept of the influence, at least in America, of Asians. So For example, many people have come to the U.S., immigrants, really relatively poor. My father was one of them. He came from India and literally had nothing. Worked full time, put himself through college, and you know, he was pretty successful in his life, and you know, and as a result of a lot of his choices and decisions and actions, then you know, I'd say in many ways I was born on third base. I had two loving parents who supported me and whatnot, and I think I did okay for myself. But you see in modern society, the example of many of these really poor immigrants, you see it in places like New York City, like with some of those charter schools like Stuyvesant, many of those Asians who get into those schools, they're dirt poor, very below, like a poverty line, slightly above the poverty line and whatnot. And they end up doing really well. And in modern society, you find that there's this criticism. They often are called, well, look, if you point to that example, that they say that you're white adjacent. The reason for their success is because they have bought into and participated in white supremacy. And this is just something that you hear, like people who are really focused on these concepts of equity and the nature of you know, various inequities in society and institutional racism and oppression and whatnot. I'd just be curious as to what you think of any of that, and to what extent you think, you know, look, given historical injustices, how do we do a better job of rectifying issues of the past that could affect the present and the future without essentially making even a bigger mistake and essentially doing the same thing to punish those who are high achievers or who are working really hard to prove themselves? Because ultimately, in my view, if you really push equity above merit, you're discouraging anyone from really putting that effort in. In many ways, it's very self-defeating. And I'd be curious as to your views on that. And thank you so much for putting this room together. And I'll be curious as to watch the rest of your series.
Thanks a lot. I'm an immigrant too. I came here with $120 in my pocket, with the blessings of my family, and you know, worked my way up, worked four jobs, put myself through school before getting a scholarship to do my PhD, and you know, and and was teased by when I was working in the lowest rungs of a bank, stuffing envelopes for $6 an hour, was teased by in a predominantly black working environment, was teased quite often as acting white and being white, because I was punctual for work, because I studied my butt off and took my vacation time, my 1 week vacation time off at work to write my term papers, and to use my spare time at lunch not to gossip and to chat but to study. And I was constantly accused of being a brainiac and acting white and thinking white. And I think that when we sort of condescend to minorities and buy into the politics of identity and cultural particularism and pride that, any of that nonsense above universal values like resilience, like hard work, like excellence, excellence, I want to stress, and resilience and perseverance as universal values that are conducive to merit and achievement and success, we do a great disservice to people. So I think the left primarily has valorized and prioritized cultural particularism and identity politics and all the nonsense that goes with it, like, you know, whatever cultural beliefs might be affixed to a particular ethnic group, sort of being racially sensitive to those beliefs rather than saying, look, there's a pathology going on here. I mean, I say this all the time I'll just be very open here. I say this all the time to my students at DePaul when I see a whole bunch of black kids in the quad and the Asian students are in the library. I say to them, what the hell are you doing sitting here? You know, get in the library, move it. And I point my finger and say, get up. And they say, yeah, okay, prof, okay, easy on us, prof. And I said, no, easy on you. Get your asses into the library and study. You know, what are you doing sitting outside, liming, as you call it, or whatever. So I think we've just got to identify, look, that there are not all cultures are equal. I've written articles about this. Some cultures are more superior to others. there are pathological traits and behaviors that are not necessarily endemic, but inhere in certain cultures, and we've got to name them out and say that, look, hold up certain cultures like Asian cultures that have certain values that are superior in terms of their relationship to achieving success, and say these, you should pin your aspirational identity, regardless of what race or ethnicity you are. You should pin your aspirational identity on these values because they yield something that all of us want, success, and get beyond the politics of identity. I know I do this all the time. And I think we do a great disservice when we sort of let the politics of identity and cultural or ethnic or racial particularism rule or vocabulary. We're going to offend people, but in the long run, I think we're going to spell a recipe for success.
Jason, let me interrupt. You're really hitting a good point here. The typical socially intelligent person today is infused with the culture of egalitarianism to the point that it is rude to say to someone, hey, that person is superior to you because they're working hard or because they're studying hard, or to make any judgment as to inferiority or superiority is a profound offense in normal social conversation. And the fact that anybody that has intelligence is forced to submit to that and unconsciously submits to it as a standard of conduct is deplorable. And thank you for pointing it out. And it makes me realize that when I see it in conversation, hereafter, I'm going to stop and, if it's appropriate, call it out and say, look, you know, right here, there is an opportunity to make a distinction between better and lesser. And that's a good thing. And it shouldn't be rude to do that. I'll shut up now. Thank you.
Thanks, John. And I also just, for Thales, I pinned a interview that we recently did with Kenny Zhu, which was talking about the Asian success story, particularly in academics, but also how that tends to attract counter discrimination and how they're penalized for their success, and some of the actions that his group is taking to try to have some legal remedies against that. Sam, thanks for your patience.
Oh, sorry guys, I'm just listening in for now.
Sure. Alan.
Yeah, hi Jennifer, hi Jason. You know, I read that one of your goals since you took over or became head of the Atlas Society was to appeal to young people. And in that light, and I say this in reference to my challenges with my teenager, I remember reading in my recollection of it from the book called Passages, that one of the challenges of people in their 20s is trying to establish some sense of security and stability in their lives. And that being in your 20s is a very scary time for most people. And when it comes to meritocracy, I think the trap is with the current political...
Okay, it looks like he had some background interference there. I want to, again, just encourage people to raise your hands. Come on up, share some thoughts, questions. Damien. There we go. You have a question for Professor Hill? And I'm not seeing you muted, so sometimes lately it seems to be happening more and more on the platform that the people come up but are unable to speak. And so what I would recommend is that you sign out and sign back in, and then we will get you in the mix here. So there we go. And then you are Damien, if you want to unmute yourself now, I think we're going to be clear. There we go.
Hello, can you hear me now?
We hear you.
Okay, hello. Thank you. I guess, quick question. Do we grant, people the power when we entertain these arguments? Because when it comes down to, for me, is always going to be about resources. And if you don't grant people access to your resources or the fruits of your work, like, I don't understand what the argument would be from from the other side. I hope the question kind of makes sense. So do we give them power by even entertaining these arguments?
Jason?
I don't know what you mean by give who the power.
Give people. So if, to me, okay, elitism, okay. If I have something, or I create something, I produce something, I have to produce something to become elite. In a sense, we have to gain resources, gain wealth, you know. And so for me, if I don't grant, how can I give people the space to even, I don't know, argue that I owe them something? I guess that's the question I'm asking.
If I might jump in, Damien, are you talking about the distinction between equality of opportunity and equality of result? That is, everyone must have equal opportunity to get in the game and produce, as you say. And is that your question? How do we make sure that we have equality of opportunity to even play the game?
Not necessarily. My question really just revolves around why does a person have to defend themselves against like elite claims or elitism claims?
Oh, okay. Looking through the telescope backwards. Okay, now I see what you're getting at. Yeah, that's a difficult one.
Jason, you want to take a crack at that?
Yeah, I would say one has to. For a couple of reasons. I mean, look at what's going on at Harvard University with Asian students, right? Where they are having to file lawsuits because if you're an Asian student today and you're an A student, you're almost guaranteed non-admission at Harvard University. So there is a sense, and speaking as a professor of 25 years, I can assure you that if you're a person of color and having sat on the admission committees of four other universities where I taught, including one Ivy League university, that if you're a person of color and you have a B minus average, there is no progressive university or college in the United States that will accept you, that will not accept you. But if you're Asian and you're interpreted as being white adjacent, as Thierry said, you run the risk of having all of the attributes that constitute your agency as being an efficacious one used against you. And that seems to be quite unjust, because one has, through tenacity and resilience and a great deal of discipline, built an agency and built one's meritorious agency into something quite wonderful, and then one is penalized for it. So we do live in a society in which egalitarianism sort of rules in a sense, and we envy or we despise, might be a too strong word, but we certainly envy, or in some sense we disparage those who are meritorious, and we deny them entrance into the pantheon of academic institutions or corporate, you know, let's just stick with academia for a while. So one has to defend oneself if one finds oneself in the position of being punished or being left out of institutions, in spite of the fact that one is more than qualified for entrance. And one sees that people who are less qualified than one is being granted entrance in the name of something like equity or in the name of something like egalitarianism, or because one is a protected class. belongs to a protected class that falls along gender or racial lines that's protected by the state. So I think when one is singled out as a member of a group that does have a meritorious sort of agency affixed to one, and one is singled out as a member of that group and is punished in some sense for it by not being admitted to an institution, one has got to find a way to defend oneself. And I see no stronger way than to fall back on something like a meritocratic paradigm. I mean, I hope that answers your question, but there are lots of people out there, these K-12 programs that I talked about, where they're closing the honors programs on the grounds that they discriminate against the slow learners. Here you have a bunch of gifted students who want to learn, and you might have students who are not that gifted who can aspire to be gifted, to be high achievers, who want to pass out the standards, and they're eradicating all standards. So I think when you have annihilators and disruptors and destroyers of standards, it's bad for everybody. It's bad for the people who are high achievers, and it's bad for the people who are not there yet but aspire to be there.
Can I ask just one follow-up question? Because I understand what you're saying as far as when it comes to school and we're talking about children. But when we talk about adults, high achievers, they get results. And so for me, if society wants to, you know, penalize people who get results for whatever reason, isn't that an avenue for a strategy to just like hoard those types of people or like gather those people and, you, I guess, have a concentrated group of just those types of people who kind of been like outcasts, but they're just, you got your pretty much your own meritocracy right there. Isn't that like an avenue for that?
Well, that would assume that we'd live in a society that's not open to the admission of talent. I mean, the one thing about a meritocracy in a free society is that it's open to all persons who are committed, and that their institutions and that there are opportunities to advancing your talent, to improving your skill set, to, you know, going from, I can't tell you how many times I've been in the hospital, lots of times, I guess I have bad karma. And I have seen, you know, there's a shortage of nurses in this country. And so a lot of nurses that have dealt with me have been from the Philippines or from Africa or from the Caribbean. And there's one story that's very moving. You know, there's this Jamaican nurse, and she was a domestic servant in Jamaica, which is the country that I was born and raised in. And she came to America, taught herself to speak standard English by watching a lot of American television, got her associate's degree, worked for 3 more years, became an RN, and then got a master's degree in business because she wanted to be an entrepreneur. So this assumes that we live in a society that seems more like Europe, that would be closed off to upward mobility, and that they're not institutions that are available for us to sort of increase our skill set and achieve some semblance of some modicum of upward mobility. And I just don't think America is that country. If it were that country, we wouldn't have swarms of immigrants coming in here. And in some sense, in many, many, many cases, achieving, as Thales attested, achieving some semblance of upward mobility. So a meritocracy doesn't presuppose that it's just a hermetically closed system that is closed, that is just, you know, for an elite chosen few. It's open to all, or to as many people who are willing to improve in whatever sense they can improve. We're not all equal, so some are going to advance more than others, and because some people are just faster than others, quicker than others. But it's not a hermetically closed system, as you might find in other societies that have a fusion of meritocracy coupled with aristocracy. America just doesn't seem to be that sort of country, to me at least.
Jay, did you have something to add?
I'd like to ask a question. Was that to me, Jag? Was that?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah. Jason, what would you say is the strongest leverage point or argument for the anti-meritocracy, the egalitarian, because one of the, you know, spinoffs from Damien's question is, well, what is the moral right for someone to take my stuff or to, you know, inhibit my aspirations in my life based on their need? You know, that idea that their need or some, what is the strongest leverage point that you are aware of? Not necessarily one any one of us would agree with, but because it is hard when you bring it down to that to say, well, what is the moral point? Where does that come from? It's my life, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, I think the strongest point they would have is saying something like, if you have some sort of inherited privilege, like you come from a rich family and you have inherited generational wealth and I don't. But even then, one could say that even if I have inherited generational wealth, I still deserve it. And that's a hard pill to swallow. I deserve it because it's based on the judgment and the appraisal of my of an ancestor who, in his or her judgment, has decided to bequeath that wealth to me. So your poverty or your poverty can't be a mortgage on your needs in general. Let's not even use poverty, just basically your needs can't be a mortgage on my life, because that wealth was originally earned. I mean, let's use Thales. What if Thales' father decided to bequeath him all his money that he earned through no special help, no government help, through no strings, through his own hard efforts, and Thales decided to bequeath that money to someone else. Let's say he has children, I don't know, but, and then someone says, I my needs constitute a mortgage claim on your efforts. And the person says to Thales, well, you didn't do anything. You just inherited that money from your father. When Thales would say, well, look, that's the judgment of my father, and I am as deserving of it as any producer, because my father is the first, is the originator of that wealth, and he has the right as the owner of property in his body, and as a sole owner of the property of his body, he has the right to determine who is the beneficiary of the products of that property, which resulted from the conjoinment of reason and labor from his body. And I am that person. So no one's claim can supersede the autonomy argument. That is, I'm the autonomous owner of my body. My reason and my labor produce the wealth. I decide to give that wealth to someone else. Your needs can never, ever supersede the ownership of that which resulted from my body. And I think that's the best counter argument that one could give to someone who wants to say that my needs are so great and your position is a position that you didn't earn at all, you just inherited. Those are two stark positions. But that's the best argument that I would actually, the counter argument that I would actually give.
Thank you, Jason, and thank you, Jay. Alan, you're back.
Yes, I'm sorry for that lively interruption. But as I was saying, yeah, the 20s are characterized by this insecurity and need to find stability. And what I'm finding is that I'm sorry. What I'm finding is that the current narrative with the push for equity and all of that placates that need, whereas before the idea of meritocracy means ultimately, well, you have to work to achieve that stability, whereas the equity argument says, don't worry, we'll take care of it. You don't need to work. It will be handed to you. So the question is, how do you make meritocracy sexy for young people? Is the best way I can ask the question.
Thank you, Alan. Jason.
Yeah, Thank you, Alan. I teach the Z generation now in my classroom of 18 to 22 year olds, and it's a challenge that I face. And I don't think that one has any really business making it sexy for them at all. I say you state the facts of reality, and you equip them with an education. An education in the proper sense of the term, and I think Rand would agree with this, is that which equips them to be sovereign, autonomous individuals who can exercise jurisdiction over their bodies and navigate the world. And reality, ultimately, they're going to have to face a reality that is unforgiving and relentless. And so what I tell my students, I don't use the word sexy, but I'm really not interested in making meritocracy sexy for them. What I'm interested in doing is giving them the best education I can, honing their minds, making them, and also trained as a logician, so making them the best critical thinkers, the most well-rounded, giving them a great liberal arts education, making them well-rounded human beings, making them amazing thinkers, making them phenomenal human beings, so that when they hit the ground like the fox and they keep on running, that they can navigate the world. But this idea of trying to make something sexy for them in order to make life easy, a buffer, I think would do them a great disservice. I mean, actually what I tell them is the opposite, Alan. I tell my students that I'm really sorry, but the world is a much, much more complicated and difficult world. I'm 57 than it was when I was graduating from college in the early 90s. That it's going to be much more demanding of you. All the more reason why you've got to take your education even more seriously than I had to take my education, because the world is more complex. The world is more demanding of you. You're overly scheduled, and your resume is going to be. Your resume is going to have to be twice as filled as it was when I was graduating. So as opposed to making it more sexy for them, I actually give them a really hard dose of reality. And I said, look, some of you kids are being trained to be floor managers at Walmart, and you're paying $38,000 a year at DePaul University to be a floor manager at Walmart. So you better take your education seriously and not harbor any illusions at all, because life out there is tough, kids. So buckle up, come to class, don't miss one single class, don't roll your eyes about any of the subject matter. Buckle up, because life is tough and you have got to develop a very thick skin. And I will equip you, and along with a handful of other teachers, will try to equip you with the skill set that you will need to navigate the world. So I just think that the idea of making it sexy is a bad idea. I think what I try to do is prepare them for a reality that is very, very complex, and to make sure that when they graduate from college, they have that skill set that can navigate that very, very, very complicated reality that's going to be very demanding of them.
Thank you, Jason. Great. All right, folks, thanks. We have 6 more minutes, and I'd love to see if we can squeeze in Liberty, though I'm concerned because I can't see your mute button. So I'm worried you might not be able to unmute. Connie, can you unmute? If not, sweetheart, just slip back out and back into the room or clubhouse. Jenny?
Hi, I'm just here to listen, and it's been a good conversation. So thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Jordan, Dr. Jordan Shaw, would love to get your question for Professor Hill.
Sure. No, I just have a comment. Sorry I couldn't come up earlier when I was invited. But, as a recipient of generational wealth and knowing many people who were, I think that cronyism and nepotism are much stronger drivers than we give credit to. I think that hard work is overrated. I can think of so many instances where people have had opportunity because of who they know. I've been impacted by affirmative action. It was an opportunity that I lost, and it's happened before in public service. And so, I think that we have to certainly honor the fact that people at elite universities benefit from networking and all kinds of things. I think hard work is probably lower on my list as a predictor of success, but that's certainly not perhaps basing it on empirical data. So just wanted to offer that. Thanks.
Hi, I do want to chime in. I think Dr. Jordan is making a good point. You know, when I've been a recruiter in Silicon Valley for 20 plus years, and I don't think we always give credit to hard work. You know, I think sometimes, or maybe now, I do see the shiny penny syndrome a little bit more. So yeah, I think you made a good point. Thanks.
Well, are you both telling me that you valorize and you hire mediocrity? That even if there are people who are the beneficiaries of generational wealth, that if they display mediocrity, and you see someone who displays efficacy and talent, that you choose mediocrity over hard work and efficacy? Because if that's the case, then we're lost. We're finished as a civilization, really.
I think people get lucky. I do think that it's sometimes there are people who right time, right place, right moment, get very lucky, and then. But I don't think hard work always gets acknowledged, or. You know, we don't really, I don't know. I just don't see it. Thanks.
I mean, an example. Sorry.
No, I just want to add, like, hard work, hard work to me seems subjective in a sense sometimes, but to me, results are results. And regardless if it comes hard or easy for a person, if they can get results, that's kind of what my focus is. So I just want to throw that.
I think that's a really good point, because a lot of time people who, you know, there's working hard and there's working smart. And if you can say, well, I pulled all the all-nighters and I worked my tail off, but I still didn't get the same, you know, number of sales, or I still didn't manage to get the breakthroughs that somebody else, and he just worked half as hard. So I think when we're talking about meritocracy, we're talking about more than hard work. We're talking about, you know, can you provide value that and be in a free exchange with others who you can help?
I agree. And that's why I use the term efficacious, because I think, and I like the term working smart, because efficacious means an end result that is successful. Yeah.
Okay, well, with that, we are at time. So I want to thank everybody. Thank you, of course, Professor Hill, for this really intriguing and provocative topic. And I'm looking forward to the second part of this discussion. I put the link up there for those who want to get notices of what kinds of not just Clubhouse events, but also what kind of webinars. And of course, Professor Richard Salzman has his Morals and Markets. That's for students and young adults. So check it out, because we've got a lot going on next week. On Tuesday, we've got Robert Krasinski talking about schismatology, why groups that seem to, or you know, groups that have a lot in common, they will fracture into different groups. Then also on Tuesday, we're going to be doing a Clubhouse, Mastering Emotions and Overcoming Grudges. Wednesday, Robert Trusinski and Stephen Hicks are going to have a webinar discussing objectivism in art. And then on Thursday, we're going to have an Ask Me Anything with Richard Salzman. And and then the following Friday, a week from today, we'll have the part two of this series with Jason Hill. So thank you all, and I look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you, everybody.